China wakes. An earthquake in the era of YouTube ripples across the world.
Thousands of people camping out along the streets in little alleyways underneath tarpaulins in the pouring rain.
The death toll seems poised to rise beyond 12,000. The new China struggles to respond as the whole world watches. It's a race against time in Sichuan. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 13th. We have all the developments from China as the worst earthquake in three decades devastates a province where more than 87 million people live. Also, Myanmar may be opening to a massive relief airlift, a foregone conclusion, and West Virginia is perhaps the last hope for Hillary Clinton. And some bears wait to learn their fate. Polar bears waiting for the U.S. government? I kid you not. That and all the news. Chinese state media are reporting that as many as 18,000 people remain buried near the epicenter of yesterday's massive earthquake in the city of Dujiangyan. The Beijing government is pouring in troops to aid in the disaster recovery. So far, China state media says 1,000 students and teachers are dead or missing after the earthquake crushed a high school. Officials say the school, a 6- or 7-story building, has been reduced to a pile of rubble about 6 feet high.
Reporter Stephen McDonald is near Chengdu, where another school collapse buried 900 students.
Every time they find one of the bodies, they set up fireworks, and it's, I suppose, a way of letting the person's spirit move on to the afterlife or something like that is what they're telling us.
Meanwhile, the door seems to be opening in Myanmar. The military rulers there have agreed to accept more U.S. help. A second cargo plane has been sent in carrying blankets and water. The continued U.S. airlift could signal the beginning of a massive cyclone relief operation. Humanitarian workers believe casualties could rise above 100,000, and only a small fraction of the storm's victims have received needed aid.
With a giant lead in the polls, but a slipping count in the delegates needed for the nomination, a confident Hillary Clinton campaigned in West Virginia yesterday.
I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't believe that I could be the best president for West Virginia and America.
Clinton is expected to win today's West Virginia primary by a wide margin. Barack Obama, meanwhile, has moved on to Kentucky, where he faces another tough primary battle.
If you'll vote for me, Kentucky, on May 20th, then we'll win this nomination and we will win this general election.
The Illinois senator has picked up 26 superdelegates in the past week. At that pace, he could reach the 2,025 delegates needed to clinch the nomination in 3 weeks.
Is it 3 weeks and counting? There's no letup in the wildfires plaguing Florida's Atlantic coast. Flare-ups overnight in Brevard County town of Palm Bay. All 18 schools in Palm Bay will be closed. The Nikkei rose 200 points today. Markets are up, although signaling down on Wall Street. The question for you today is this. What's on your personal endangered list? We're going to talk about polar bears in a moment being on the endangered species list, maybe. But we have a question for you.
Yeah, we do. We're asking you what's on your personal endangered list. And we're not necessarily talking about animals. We're talking about sleep, perhaps.
What's
reading.
Going away in this crazy century?
Send it to 8778 My Take.
Or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your endangered species.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This morning, Chinese officials are reporting that more than 12,000 are dead in the Sichuan province alone. This following the 7.9 earthquake that struck the southwestern part of the country yesterday. In Mianzhu, not far from the center of the quake, officials have just reported they believe 18,000 people are buried in one city. And that number, John, is
amazing.
Very likely to go up.
Yeah.
Rescue efforts are being stalled by rain throughout the region, which is expected to last for the next couple of days. China says it would welcome international help, but even their own people are having trouble getting to the affected regions. We have two observers in China, and we're going to go first to Laura Colbert, who is 60 miles from the epicenter of the earthquake in Chengdu. And Laura, how are things there?
Well, right now it's raining really hard. As you mentioned, it's pouring, and my understanding is it is hampering efforts to for rescuers to get out there. Not much has changed in Chengdu. It's slowly getting back to business as usual. People are kind of heading out to dinner, this and that. One thing I've noticed, in fact, just recently walking from our friend's apartment to go out to eat, about a 20-minute walk, is there are dozens and dozens, I'd say even hundreds, of people out in tents or under tarps, many of whom are just afraid to go back into their buildings.
And was there just an aftershock? Recently, there's been hundreds of them since yesterday.
Yeah.
But did you just feel one big one?
There was one not that long ago that was quite big and somewhat sustained. You know, sort of leading people to think, oh, is this another one? I think it was just another aftershock, but surprisingly big one, bigger than the tremors we felt earlier.
And I can imagine that, of course, is just adding to the anxiety that people are feeling there. You actually speak Mandarin, and you've been speaking to people. What are they telling you?
I'm actually just gone out to dinner and was speaking to this family at a table nearby. And they have a relative in the affected area in Wenchuan, or near Wenchuan. And this family actually is originally from that area, had moved into the city several years ago to work. And the mother of the father of the family is in that area. And they're quite concerned, as you might imagine, because they can't call, they can't email, they can't get any information to her or get any information out from that area. And they're just hoping, you know, at some point they can reach her.
And the numbers just keep going up, the number of dead and the number buried. Laura Colbert, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Also on the line with us this morning is Sharong Chen, the BBC's China desk editor, and has been following the story as the reports have come in. And Sharong, the government response, we understand that it is pouring rain right now, but there's been a tremendous amount of information that officials have been imparting as they go about trying to develop their recovery strategy. Can you tell us what's happening at this time?
What's happening is soldiers and military police have managed to get to the epicenter and the worst hit areas. And reports are saying there are 6,000 soldiers in the areas and 18,000 of them more are on their way to Henan. This is from a neighboring military command. So that's the kind of basic force they can use. And because of the area is so mountainous and very difficult to reach because of the communication links were broken. So it's the soldiers who were able to get there first. The Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao flew to the capital city of Chengdu, where your first speaker is staying. He went on to travel to a nearby city, Mianyang, and he is there to coordinate efforts to rescue those who are still buried under the rubble, as
Sharong,
you say.
Sharong Chen, let me ask you a question about the tone of the government's response here. Are they saying, and government media, are they saying to the people of China, don't worry, we're going to rescue you, we've got the situation under control, or is it more a sense of we're a nation that's grieving, this is a horrible tragedy, and clearly there's going to be a large loss of life?
Well, the message from the Chinese media is more or less like the whole country is united in their effort to do the search and rescue at this stage. And when at the peak of the chaos, when everybody was trying to call, the Xinhua news agency even put up a message to say, if you manage to get through, please be brief so that, you know, you give space to others as well. The Chinese media has been able to sort of mobilize the masses and to sort of set the mood. It's not so much of a grief, but more like we are united as a nation. And one commentator even say, if we cannot control nature, at least we can deal with it with China speed.
Boy, an extraordinary response given in the past. The Chinese officials tried to hide, like, say, in 1976 when there was an enormous earthquake. Very different today. They're responding to this natural disaster.
You're right. Over 30 years ago, when the earthquake hit northeast of Tangshan City and a quarter of a million people were basically wiped out, at that time, not only were the news kept from the public, but also it was not treated as a kind of natural disaster or urgent disaster until quite a few weeks afterwards. And this time around, with the information, access to information so widespread, it's no use to keep people from anything, even though they tried a few years back during the SARS outbreak.
Shering Chen, BBC's China Desk editor, we thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
One of the most amazing things about this is how, as Sharon Chen was saying, this is a window into the new China. We are seeing the face of the new China. As tragic and horrific as the reports are, this is what the new China looks like. There are enormous numbers of machines and resources being brought to bear, the mobilizing of the Chinese army. This is a nation in the 21st century dealing with a 21st century tragedy. And joining us now from Washington, D.C., where the International Red Cross is also monitoring this tragedy and the other one nearby in South Asia in Myanmar, Nan Bizard joins us. Thank you for being with us. And this, I suspect, is a tough couple of weeks for the International Red Cross.
Well, it's true. We do have the very big situation in Myanmar and now the China earthquake. But the Red Cross is a worldwide organization with a lot of resources and a lot of disaster response expertise. So I wouldn't say we're stretched, but everyone is certainly alert to these two very large disasters.
You know, one of the things that we were hearing from the BBC is this is a very different China that's responding to this disaster than 30 years ago, which on one level is obvious. But you, who have a history institutionally with the Chinese going back that period of time, what do Red Cross workers think about the way China has responded to this?
Well, obviously, I think everyone is quite impressed by the very rapid mobilization and the very transparent and urgent response effort that's underway. It's very difficult access, as everyone knows, with roads blocked. Now we have a terrible rain there. And, of course, one thing that very much hampers response is the very strong and regular aftershocks, which not only terrify people who have survived the first earthquake, but certainly make additional obstacles for aid workers. So we're certainly alert to that. The Chinese Red Cross, or the Red Cross Society of China, is a very strong national society. It's got 70,000 branches. It's got tens of thousands of volunteers and aid workers, and they've been responding to disasters for many years. They've been in touch with us, the American Red Cross, as well as the International Federation of the Red Cross, with lots of information about the kinds of needs that they will be expecting, a lot of relief supplies and international aid that they will be requesting.
Quickly, by contrast, Myanmar is not known for its cooperation, does not have a big infrastructure in place, and it's expected that 2 million people have been affected by the cyclone, perhaps 100,000 of them dead. What's your cooperation or response there?
Well, we've been very fortunate. Again, as I said, there's a national society, a Red Cross or Red Crescent national society in almost every country in the world, and there is one in Myanmar. We've been very fortunate that while any entity in Myanmar does work closely with the government, that has been true in this case in a positive way for the Myanmar Red Cross. The American Red Cross and the rest of the Red Cross movement have been able to get relief supplies in every day. We've had international staff down in the Delta, the very first who have been accompanied by the government to do an assessment. So while we're certainly
that's a great track record. We have to go right now, but thank you very much for joining us. We should point out the U.S. has a second plane into Myanmar, so the possibility of a really serious global relief effort in Myanmar seems to be taking shape. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today, John, polar bears are on the agenda in Washington, D.C., and the question is whether or not they should be labeled as endangered species. And so we are asking folks today to tell us what's on their personal endangered list. And here's what someone had to say.
Good morning. This is Troy Erickson calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And on my personal endangered list is my belief that my children will be able to financially surpass me.
Wow, that is some dark stuff. People are not looking forward to this century, but people don't have to have an endangered species. They can have an endangered anything, as that caller suggested, and they can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
As we said, polar bears today. The White House is facing opposition over its stance on global warming. A collection of environmental groups have come together to pressure the government to declare polar bears an endangered species.
The poor polar bears.
The poor polar bears.
Beleaguered polar bears.
A judge has actually stepped in, ordering the Department of Interior to decide whether to put the polar bear on the endangered list by Thursday, as in this week. Robert Buchanan is the president of Polar Bears International. Robert, why is the polar bear in trouble?
Well, the polar bear is in trouble because it all boils down to one simple thing, and that is ice. Without ice, polar bears can't hunt, they can't breed, and in most cases, they can't den. So polar bears just simply cannot survive without ice. The current conditions in the Arctic is that probably by another 5 years, in the summertime, the Arctic will be totally ice-free. So, once again, without ice, there's not any polar bears.
But if you put the polar bear on the endangered list, let's say it happens tomorrow, I mean, how would that help, say, Friday?
It's not going to have any immediate effect. The real corporate here is all of us. Many of us try to put our heads in the sand and are in denial that, like a death of a loved one, we don't want to admit that it has happened, and that we remain in denial that this climate situation is changing so dramatically. What we've seen happen in the last 15 years usually takes 2,000 years to transpire. So it's not a matter of, has this happened before? Yes, but animals have had a chance to adapt or change or find geographic pockets where the species might be able to survive. So there's not going to be a lot that happens on Friday.
I do yearn, though, to know why it is of significance to the polar bear, why, you know, that they would be declared an endangered species. I mean, it's certainly not going to cause the ice to refreeze anytime soon, but are there any things that can be done in the interim to assist the polar bear in finding alternative breeding environments, making a retreat into the deep Arctic more satisfying and viable for them?
Well, a retreat into the deep Arctic, they already are there, so there's no place to retreat. That's number one. And the deeper waters of the Arctic are not very productive. It's really around the continental shelf that they find the food that's necessary, which is primarily ring seals. So why the polar bear? Why is there a lot of commotion about this charismatic megafauna? Is because of that.
Charismatic megafauna?
Megafauna, uh-huh.
Is that your term or is that a biologically precise term?
Well,
I love it, whatever it is.
It's just kind of a little saying that we have that really puts a spin on what this great lord of the Arctic really is. Let's face it. I mean, the polar bear is North America's heritage. It's what we're all about. I mean, we have 80% of the polar bears if you look at both of the bodies of water on either side of the North America. So
Well, it's also really scary in that polar bears, Adora, mm-hmm. and back me up on this, are at the mm-hmm. top of the food chain in the Arctic, right? And
yeah, they absolutely are.
And we are at the top of the food chain. And in an environment mm-hmm. of climate change, being at the mm-hmm. top of the food chain is not a big advantage. Correct?
Let's face it. If you have an animal that can live in total darkness, can live at triple-digit minus degree numbers, can survive through all these very harsh conditions, and then suddenly is in trouble, I have to say that it certainly is a sentinel species for mankind. It's a warning flag that, you know, is man in the crosshairs of extinction? Yeah, probably so. At the same time, it's important, it would be naive to think that man can't get out of that crosshairs of extinction. Are we going to lose polar bears? We definitely will probably lose at least two-thirds of them by mid-century, maybe worse.
This mm-hmm. is clearly a very contentious issue. Mm-hmm. I understand mm-hmm. there's been something near 700,000 public comments that the Department of Interior mm-hmm. has gotten mm-hmm. people feeling very strongly on both mm-hmm. sides of the mm-hmm. issue. We actually, I should say, extended an invitation to the Department of the Interior to come speak with us about this issue, but mm-hmm. they said it's in the middle of a court case, and so therefore they weren't ready to talk about it at this point. So let's talk practically speaking. Mm-hmm. There was a sense by Greenpeace and some other groups that the Department of Interior was really dragging their feet, so they took them to court. What's happening there?
Well, biodiversity is the one that really carried the suit across to push the issue on the matter. They got three choices. Either they make a decision that the polar bears are threatened or that it's not threatened, or, which I kind of personally think will happen, is they won't make a decision. But that doesn't mean I'm right. I'm not always right at all. They have not made a decision two or three times before on this. So what is the consequences of them not making a decision? Just more legal ramifications. So there's a good chance, I think, that they just won't make a decision.
So the polar bear really is a symbol where we've just got a few minutes, Robert, but it's really mm-hmm. a symbol of some greater issues of the global climate.
It definitely is. This is not really a right issue or a left issue. You know, people get involved in, did man cause this or didn't cause that? Who cares? Man's got to solve this problem. You know, this planet is, 4.5 billion years old, and 99% of the species on it are now extinct.
Robert Buchanan, thanks so much. Buchanan is the president of Polar Bears International. Now time for more headlines from Femi Okeh.
It's 29 minutes past the hour, and in central China, heavy rain is hindering rescue efforts. Thousands of people are trapped in rubble more than 24 hours after a 7.9 earthquake shook the region. And in other international news... That's the sounds of a U.S. military C-130 plane being unloaded off supplies. The military government in Myanmar says it remains opposed to letting in foreign aid workers to help cyclone victims. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appealed to the junta to allow more aid into the country. And that's a quick look at your headlines. More later.
Good news there in Myanmar. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day. A short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. The polls have opened in West Virginia in a contest the outcome of which is not really in doubt. Hillary Clinton is expected to score a double-digit victory over Barack Obama, but the AP is reporting this morning that with the number of superdelegates who have declared for Barack Obama in the last week, it appears as though Barack Obama is on track to clinch the nomination in the next 3 weeks. Of course, superdelegates know what's in their own mind and not the Associated Press. Joining us now to talk about the Hillary Clinton campaign is John Broner, who's covering Hillary Clinton for the New York Times and is in West Virginia or on his way there. I guess you'll be at the victory party in Charleston. John, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Anytime.
The outcome is not in doubt. The electorate in West Virginia is very, very interesting if we think about the general election in November. What does Hillary Clinton hope to take out of this contest? And in some sense, is the press corps holding a bit of a vigil to see what happens next with Hillary Clinton?
Well, we're certainly holding a vigil to see what happens over the next couple of weeks in this contest. It's still a bit of a mystery what Mrs. Clinton wants from these remaining weeks. She's clearly going to win a sizable victory tonight in West Virginia, and most likely, if she's still in it, in Kentucky next week, which will be probably more than balanced by Obama's large win in Oregon, which has more delegates, after all, than Kentucky does. Is this a bargaining position? Is this a point of pride? Do her people still honestly believe that she can somehow wrest the nomination away from Mr. Obama? It's still rather unclear, but I think she has a point to make about Mr. Obama's weaknesses with certain sectors of the electorate, much discussed older voters, white working class voters, and West Virginia and Kentucky are full of them.
Well, I don't want to drag you New York Times people into the speculation zone because I know how allergic you are, all are to that, and Adora will always back you guys up on that, much though I try to push you. But let's talk about this bargaining position scenario that you alluded to a moment ago. What would this be, bargaining to be on the ticket, to have influence at the convention? What sort of bargaining scenario are we looking at here?
Well, I believe there are very few people who know whether Senator Clinton is even interested in a position on the ticket or whether Senator Obama is inclined to offer her one. She and her husband are and will remain very important figures in the Democratic Party, regardless of how this ends. Although, you know, many of her backers, particularly Rahm Emanuel, put it well, the future of the Democratic Party and its prospects in the fall depends how the winner wins and how the loser loses. So I think both sides are positioning themselves to do this as gracefully and magnanimously as possible. Where the two will ultimately end up, as you say, I'm not willing to speculate.
Well, how the winner wins tonight is something you will witness in person in Charleston. John Broner is covering Hillary Clinton for the New York Times. John, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, anytime.
28 delegates at stake in West Virginia.
West Virginia is a real indicator of which way the political winds are going to blow come the November election. It's going to be up to you. Come on out and help pick the next president.
Well, that's certainly what Hillary hopes anyway as she campaigns in West Virginia. She has a 20 to 40 point lead over Barack Obama, depending on which survey you believe. But the race is energizing new voters if the end result isn't unclear, if I can just get that out. Particularly high school and college students across the state, just as it did nearly 50 years ago in the Kennedy versus Humphrey race. Rod Snyder is the president of the West Virginia Young Democrat.
Who probably doesn't remember Hubert Humphrey.
No, he probably doesn't remember that. But what he does know, Rob, right, is that in West Virginia, folks are really excited about this election. What's got you so jazzed up?
Well, the young voters are extremely excited about today. As you said, it's been a long, long time since West Virginia has been able to be part of the nominating process in any meaningful way. And we're seeing, I think we're definitely going to break records today with turnout among young voters. We're also seeing a lot of new mobilization for our organization, a lot of new local clubs of the Young Democrats springing up all across the state, particularly in high schools. It's great to see the 18-year-olds who are getting to vote for the first time actually excited about it.
And let me ask you this, though. At the end of the day, there's so many who believe that ultimately what happens in West Virginia really isn't relevant in the long term. Are voters feeling that? Is there discussion about where the race is and whether or not handing Hillary Clinton a victory really matters at this point?
No, I don't think you can convince the voters here today that it doesn't matter. I mean, the buzz and enthusiasm is quite high. It's just, even though we're one of the late states, I think the fact that we actually have had Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both in the state several times over the past week or two has meant a lot to the people here. Usually we don't see anybody until closer to October or November, and so, regardless of what the delegate count is right now, people are quite excited.
In other states, we've seen a lot of young people supporting Barack Obama. Is that the case there in West Virginia? When you look at these polls, it certainly seems that the vast majority of voters there are backing Hillary Clinton.
I would say that the same trend is happening here amongst young voters. I think you see a lot of young voters supporting Barack Obama. It might not be as heavily tilted as some other states across the country, but certainly in just some anecdotal straw polls and meetings and things that I've collected, especially the high school and college students, you're seeing a lot of support for Barack Obama. Our organization runs up to age 35, and so some of the older young professionals are probably a little more split than you would see elsewhere. That's kind of my anecdotal evidence.
Rod Snyder, thank you. He's the president of the West Virginia Young Democrats, and he joined us from Jefferson County, and he's real excited.
Even though the contest, the outcome is completely clear. That's what's amazing about this election.
It is amazing. Right now, though, more headlines from Femi Oke.
It's 21 minutes to the hour, and of course, the West Virginians are voting in a Democratic primary today.
I think he has closed it out. I think Hillary and her camp are the only ones who think he hasn't.
So one of the voters voting in West Virginia today. Polls expect Hillary Clinton to be a clear winner. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says turmoil in financial markets has eased a little bit. He credits the central bank's steps to aid banks and large investment firms for the improvement, but admits the situation is still, and I quote, far from normal. The Detroit City Council is due to vote this morning on a trio of resolutions that could decide the fate of the city's defiant, scandal-plagued mayor. The council could remove Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick from office, ask the governor of Michigan to do it, or slap Kilpatrick, on the wrist. And finally, let's end our news on a stylish note. The movie Sex and the City has just opened in London, starring Carrie Bradshaw and Mr. Big.
Should we get you a diamond?
No, just get me a really big closet.
There's been just a little bit of controversy as the movie, famously set in New York, had its world premiere in the United Kingdom. Sex and the City opens in the US May the 30th. Don't forget that, John.
Oh, yeah, I'll put it right on the calendar. We should note that...
But it is interesting, though, they opened in London and 2 weeks ahead of the opening here in the United States.
Because the movie house New Line Cinema likes to do that in the UK first before coming back
to
the US. You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're following breaking financial news. Ben Bernanke's remarks on financial turmoil have suggested that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is going to open lower this morning. Futures are way down. We're also following breaking news about the Chinese earthquake. State media says more than 18,000 people are buried in just one city close to the epicenter. The death toll from the quake is expected to rise even higher. There are thousands still trapped in collapsed buildings. We're going to have more on China, but we're going to go back to politics in a moment. Today, there's a West Virginia primary, Adora.
And people are voting.
And a long time ago, it came down to West Virginia.
I guarantee you that if he carries West Virginia, he'll win the nomination, and once more we'll have a Democrat in the White House. Thank you very much.
Back in 1960, that was Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr., the son of the late president, FDR, claiming that JFK, if he won West Virginia, he would win the nomination and be the president of the United States. It turned out that was true in that hard-fought campaign back
in 1960. But Kennedy at that time was trailing by 20%, 20 percentage points. He had an uphill battle.
He had an uphill battle, and there were serious demographic issues in West Virginia then as now, although back then it wasn't about race. It was much more about religion.
West Virginia, as you know, has less members of my faith than any state in the United States. Population is about 3 or 4%.
He was talking about Catholics, right?
Yes. And unlike today, where it's just two people in West Virginia, there were a number of candidates. Here's JFK referring to him being in a pack of Democrats in West Virginia back then.
I am traveling around West Virginia, as you know, as one of a series of itinerant candidates for the Democratic nomination.
A little of JFK's charm there, but he was running with Lyndon Johnson. Against Lyndon Johnson, against Stuart Symington, against Adlai Stevenson, against Hubert Humphrey. And it was a very, very tough race back in the old machine days.
Well, yeah, speaking of the machine, essentially Johnson, Symington, and Stevenson, they all avoided the primary because they were hoping for what we call today backroom deals back then. Didn't work for them, though.
But, you know, it's interesting because you've got Bill Clinton, a former president, campaigning for Hillary. You've got Obama, who's the sort of JFK-like character in this race, although West Virginians seem to be going for the establishment Hillary Clinton. I guess if you want to compare, campaigners in West Virginia today versus then, FDR Jr. is a little bit like Chelsea Clinton. Here's FDR Jr. supporting John Kennedy.
In other talks, FDR Jr. has said, John Kennedy has the same heart, the same feeling for the people as my father. He is picking up where my father left off. Remember this when you vote on May 10th. Vote Kennedy.
And, of course, Kennedy had a big advantage. He could roll out his entire family.
Yeah, I had big numbers there. And it's just fascinating to listen to that old tape because those ads are a little different than the ones we hear today, those political ads.
Well, and also, you know, it's a 24-hour news cycle. Even though Bill and Hillary Clinton are the only two campaigners,
right.
Big campaigners for Hillary, in this environment where there's the Internet and YouTube and all of us.
Seems like there's many more of them.
That's right. You can make a whole clan of Kennedys out of two Clintons in the 21st century. That's true. That's
great. Okay, we're going to be back with more on what's developing in China in the aftermath of that powerful earthquake.
That's right.
We'll be back.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Our top story, of course, the rapidly developing situation in central China after an earthquake yesterday, 7.9 on the Richter scale. And Chinese media within the last 2 hours has begun reporting that 18,000 people are believed buried and trapped, their fate unknown in a city very, very close to the epicenter. The death toll has topped 12,000 at this point. And as we've spoken about already in the hour, we have a political story here. We have, of course, a humanitarian disaster, but we also have a geological story. And joining us now is Roger Billam, who's a professor of geological sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder. This is a very active plate tectonic zone in the Chengdu area. Roger Billam has been to Chengdu and has done extensive research there, both on the geography and the changes that have taken place in the last 30 years when the last earthquake occurred. Professor Billam, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, a lot of people, you know, may have the impression that China in this part of Sichuan, and it once was, but maybe not today, is very rural, very sort of primitive as far as infrastructure is concerned. But in fact, 87 million people or more live here. And combined with the fact that it's right on the edge of two very, very active plates, this is a combination that could conceivably spell disaster, even above the death toll that we've already seen. True?
Well, yes. What's happening here is that the Tibetan plateau is being extruded. It's being pushed eastwards over the plain that Chengdu is sitting on. And the rate is about 10 millimeters a year. So the calculations from the earthquake records yesterday suggest that the earthquake slipped on average about 5 meters, which suggests that these earthquakes happen about every 500 years. And in fact, there was a very large earthquake in the region in 1933.
And with the amount of building that's taken place in Sichuan, I mean, this is a boom town. It, some places are called like the Detroit of China. There are auto factories there. We've already heard of the destruction of an ammonia plant yesterday that caused all sorts of contamination of populated areas. I mean, it's a very different situation than 1976. And how vulnerable are people in these populated areas?
Well, the vulnerability is proportional to the strength of the buildings they live in. One of the problems is in the current building boom in China is that a lot of buildings have gone up. We're not sure how many had earthquake resistance. Of course, it's beginning to emerge that a lot of that construction is, in fact, inadequate to cope with strong shaking. One of the, what we've noticed in the past 50 years is the doubling of population is resulting in huge construction plans all over the planet. And the problem areas are those areas that have earthquakes like most of the Chinese or central China, parts of India, the Himalaya and so on. These areas often put earthquake-resistant construction at a very low priority because there are other problems. In China, this really shouldn't be the case because they've had a very strong earthquake program for many decades.
I mean, it's actually shocking to hear that a seven-story school collapsed to a pile of rubble 6 inches high or even a little bit more than that.
Well, it would be a little bit more, but your point is well taken. One of the things that earthquake engineers always try to guarantee is the availability of strength in schools, hospitals, and fire stations. And what we're looking at now is something that's sort of endemic in the third world that those structures are not strong enough, and they should be.
Professor Bilham, we understand there's been roughly 300 aftershocks. Is that surprising to you? And what would you be expecting as someone who's studied this area?
No, the number of aftershocks is pretty typical. This is a huge earthquake. It's not a great earthquake. You require a magnitude. It needs to be about an 8 to be a great earthquake, so we haven't quite reached that. But this earthquake is of the sort that if it had hit Chengdu directly, would have resulted in a huge death toll. Right now, the death toll is around about 10,000. My feeling is it's probably going to rise because typically when you have large populations visited by an earthquake very close to it. If you get a direct hit on a city, you can kill as many as 12% of the population.
Roger Bilham, thanks a lot. Roger Bilham, of course, is a professor of geological sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Adora?
And as you said at the top of this segment, the death toll from the devastating quake in China is nearing 12,000. At least two Chinese-American tourists are counted among the missing. Officials expect the death toll to rise as the search continues for thousands of people buried in the rubble. There's pressure on organizers at this time of the Beijing Olympics to alter or suspend the Olympic torch relay, which was actually scheduled to pass through the affected area next month. Joining us now is Michael Bristow, a correspondent for the BBC, and he is just north of Chengdu, China. And Michael Bristow, what are you seeing?
Well, if I can just follow up on one of the comments your contributors made there about the state of Chinese modern buildings. In actual fact, I'm in a city called Dujiangyan, which is about 30 miles north of Chengdu. I'm about 50 miles away from the epicenter of the earthquake. And in this city, most of the buildings have remained standing, and most of those that are standing are quite modern buildings, although most of those that seem to have collapsed in the centre of the city were the older buildings. Although I must say I did see some newer buildings, some apartment blocks that people haven't even moved into yet that had cracks in them and hadn't fallen down, but they had certainly been damaged by the earthquake. So a mixed message there about the construction of new Chinese buildings.
Well, how would you describe the people that you've encountered? Describe what they've been telling you.
Well, the people are pretty scared. I mean, I'm looking around. I mean, it's nightfall now. There's a torrential rain falling, and I'm looking around, and the houses and the apartment blocks around me are completely empty. People have just evacuated them. As another one of the contributors has just mentioned there, there's been a number of aftershocks. We felt quite a large one earlier on today. In fact, there was one, again, just about half an hour ago. People just don't want to stay in their houses, so they've set up this makeshift camp along the side where I'm sitting now of a tent. Well, most of them aren't even tents. They're just pieces of plastic which they've strung between trees and a large umbrella, anything really, just to keep off this torrential rain. So they're quite scared, and a lot of people actually left the area and headed back to Chengdu. And earlier on today, we heard that there was going to be a very, very large aftershock, and people were quite scared and tried to get out of the city as quickly as possible.
Michael, do you have any details on this state media report that 18,000 people are buried nearby to where you are? Any details?
I don't have any details about that, unfortunately. I'm in one place, and I can tell you what I've seen and what it is around me. But what I can say is that it's information seems to be coming out very, very slowly, because although the emergency services have managed to get to the city where we are here now, it's quite a low-lying area. There's a good road, a good expressway between Chengdu and Dujiangyan. And further up the road, into the foothills of the Tibet Qinghai Plateau, it gets higher, the roads are less good, there's been landslides, and rescue services have found it very, very difficult to actually get there. So I think today they only managed to get there today, and the first people to get there managed to arrive on foot. They had to get there on foot. So there's probably lots of people still buried, still trapped, and unfortunately that have died that we haven't heard of yet.
Many struggles ahead. Michael Bristow, correspondent for the BBC, thank you very much for joining us from Chengdu, China. Adora?
We're going to turn now to Andrew Jacobs of the New York Times, who's monitoring things from Beijing. Andrew, thanks for being with us. And tell us a little bit about this efforts by the Chinese government, which they've been very vocal about and transparent, it seems, in detailing exactly what they are trying to do to help all of these people who are in dire need.
Well, it's pretty massive effort. About 50,000 soldiers have been sent there, and thousands of other medics and rescue workers. And in contrast to, it seems, the past disasters, it's a pretty well-organized and well-publicized effort.
How would you describe the coverage of state media of what's happening?
It's very similar to what you might see during disaster in the States. Wall endless coverage. A lot of reporters from the Chinese media are out there giving live broadcasts from the scene. People I talk to, analysts say it's pretty unprecedented. Foreign reporters have been, as long as they can get there, they're allowed to get there. On the internet, lots of homemade video taken on cell phone.
Well, Andrew, it's amazing. It's amazing to see how this unfolds. We're going to have to go, but thank you very much. Andrew Jacobs, correspondent for the New York Times in Beijing.
And we're going to continue following that story in China. And we're still asking you just to switch completely what's on your personal endangered list. And you can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All sorts of things on our website. We'll see you tomorrow.
Supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.